From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. From specks of pollen to towering trees, at the bottom of lakes, layers of sediment have preserved ancient tree pollen. What can this pollen reveal? Matthew Fitzpatrick of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science describes how sequencing the pollen's DNA can help researchers understand how trees respond to climate change. Then, Jolie McCatherin of the Maryland Big Tree Program tells us where to find soaring saplings across the state and describes the special formula used to rank them.
The circumference is always in inches, the height is in feet, and then we do feet of the spread, and we divide that by four, and that adds up to a total point of the tree.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. The key to understanding how climate change has impacted our forests is found in an unexpected place. Tiny grains of ancient tree pollen preserved in layers of sediment gathered from lake beds. Scientists can dissect the sediment, gather the pollen, sequence its DNA, and compare it to present-day trees. What can ancient tree pollen tell us about what Maryland's forests used to look like? What does pollen DNA tell us about how trees respond to climate change? Joining us to answer these questions is Matt Fitzpatrick, Associate Professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. He joins us on the line from Frostburg. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Your research relies on sediment cores that have been collected from lakes. Tell us about the cores. How are they formed?
These are lakes that were formed after the ice sheet present during the last ice age in northern North America retreated and melted as climate warmed. And so those lakes filled in depressions left after the ice. And through time, sediment accumulates in the bottom of these lakes. So streams running in will bring sediment into the lakes. And at times of the year, like now, right? Now's a good time to talk about pollen because we see it on our cars. We might see it in puddles in the street and things like that. So every year when spring comes around, pollen will land on the surface of these lakes, eventually settle to the bottom, get accumulated with the sediments, and over many, many years, it eventually builds a story of forest composition through time.
A story in the different kinds of pollen that layer at the bottom of the lake?
That's right. So, you can imagine a lake somewhere and a forest around that lake and certain trees living around the lake in that forest. And every spring they're producing pollen, and that pollen will land on the lake surface and sink to the bottom. Over long periods of time, as the climate changes and warms, some of those species will die out there and new species will replace them. And so the pollen coming into the lake will reflect those changes in composition over long periods of time.
How are these cores of sediment collected?
It's not overly technical, actually. You usually take a boat out into the deepest part of the lake. It might just be two canoes, and you put a platform on the boat, and you drive a piece of pipe into the sediment, like a long straw, drinking straw, and you try to get all the way down to bedrock because that takes you back to sort of day one, if you will, in the life of the lake. And then you extract that piece of pipe, and you have, if you're lucky, a nice long piece of mud that could be anywhere from a few feet to many feet in length, depending on the age of the lake and how much sediments were accumulated during the life of the lake.
How long are they?
So it depends on the age of the lake and the rate at which sediments have come in through time. For a lake that has a very long time series, say in the order of 10 to 20,000 years, they could be 2 meters or more in length. Other lakes that maybe aren't as old or the sediment isn't coming in as quickly, they might only be 1 meter in length, so about 3 feet or something.
So the length of your core is a measure of time.
it's both time and the amount of sediment coming in from rivers or streams or things like that that are bringing sediment into the lake.
But you don't know any given core. You don't know what time span it is until you've analyzed it.
That's right. They use a process of radiocarbon dating to estimate different ages at different depths of the sediment core.
So you've got this big cylinder of sediment. How do you get the pollen in shape to actually analyze it?
Right. So there's a whole process of extracting the pollen from the sediment itself. It involves removing a small amount of sediment from, you know, a layer of interest, and then going through a process of washing the sediment to get it out of the to get the pollen out of the sediments, removing other organic material to isolate the pollen. If you look at just the organic material that comes out of these cores, it's not just pollen. There's bits of leaves. There's all sorts of other things in there that are not pollen. And so there's techniques that are used to isolate the pollen itself from that other material.
Is it easy to tell what type of tree the pollen comes from?
Yes and no. Different plants have different shapes to their pollen, and there's lots of different ways that the pollen can differ. They might be shaped like a football, or they might be round, or they might have three lobes on them. They might be spiky. They might be smooth, all that sort of thing. So often we can say, you know, this is from an oak tree, this is from a maple tree, this is from grass, that sort of thing. But it's often a lot more difficult to say, this is a red oak, this is a white oak, because within groups of trees, the pollen is rarely different enough that we're able to isolate it at the level of species.
So you get to the point where you can look at the DNA of the pollen. What does that tell you?
When we look at the DNA, our hope is that there are patterns there that are consistent with what we would expect in terms of population sizes and how they should have been responding to changes in climate at the same time.
Well, when you compare the DNA of ancient pollen to the DNA of present-day pollen, what are you looking for?
We can certainly make those comparisons, but it's important to distinguish between the sorts of information we can get from modern DNA versus what we can get from ancient DNA. So, we think about DNA as this strand of letters, and an entire sequence of DNA from an individual is extremely long. From the species that we're working with, which is red spruce, there are about 22 billion base pairs in the genome of red spruce. And so you could think of that as a book made of 22 billion letters. With modern DNA, we can pretty much sequence every letter and read every page in the book very easily and have a very good understanding of the genomic sequence in modern samples. When we look at these ancient samples, the book has sort of been put through a shredder. Just through time, the DNA degrades. And so instead of having this book that's built from words and sentences, we now are lucky if we get a sequence of a few words. And so that limits us a lot more in the sorts of inferences we can get from the ancient DNA and the comparisons we can make to the modern DNA. But we can say something about how diverse these populations were in terms of their genetic diversity. And we can also get some inference about the population size at different times.
That's Matt Fitzpatrick of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Fitzpatrick and a team of scientists are working to sequence DNA held within the ancient pollen of trees in order to learn how trees respond to climate change. How can climate change cause trees to migrate? We think of animals migrating, but trees?
Yeah, so, I mean, a good way to think about this, if you've done any gardening or landscaping in your yard, you go out and you buy plants, and often on the tag it'll say something about the growth zone of that species, like where can it grow, will it be able to survive in your yard, And does it like sun? Does it like shade? Does it like wet? Does it like dry? And so that's telling you something about the conditions that that plant prefers to be in. If we think about trees, right, they're obviously rooted in the ground, and over their lifetimes, and certainly our lifetimes, we don't really see them moving, but they are producing seed. Those seeds are either falling to the ground or they're getting picked up by an animal like a squirrel and being moved to a location somewhere else, or perhaps like a maple tree, if there's a wind, the seeds are blown on the wind and they could go potentially pretty far. If those seeds land in a place that is suitable, right, like climate, if you think about climate changing and that seed now moving to a location that previously was too cold or too dry or what have you, but is now warmer and wetter because the climate has changed, that in that seed may sprout and grow in that location, produce its own offspring. And so over centuries, really, trees can move along the landscape and migrate. And in the northern hemisphere, when climate changes and when it's changed in the past, we see these migrations of the forest from the south to the north, or we see them going from low elevations up elevation, trying to find their suitable habitat. It's all this process of seed dispersal, seedlings maturing to adults, and that process repeating itself over and over again.
So you've been looking at red spruce. Has red spruce migrated?
It has migrated quite dramatically since the last ice age, 20,000 years ago. So if we go back about 20,000 years, there was a very large ice sheet covering most of northern North America. In some places, it was about 2 miles thick, and it went as far south as New York City, Chicago, even as far south as St. Louis, potentially. So at that time, the climate was a lot colder. The ice sheet was influencing climate dramatically over very large areas. And looking back to the forest at that time in Maryland, the pollen cores from this part of the world suggest the vegetation at the time was much more like what you'd see in, say, northern Alaska.
Hmm. And so the red spruce was up there and now it's here? Or?
Right. So red spruce is a conifer species. It's a needle leaf tree that likes cool, moist conditions. So if we would go back several thousand years, red spruce would be much more common in the southern Appalachians and perhaps along the coastal regions of the southeastern United States. As the climate warmed, the species moved to the north, and that process continued to today, where we find red spruce is very common in New England, in the mountains of New England, and southern Canada. But in this part of the world, in Maryland, we only find it in a few locations, in basically in westernmost Maryland and high elevation wetlands. And then to the south, we find it in high elevations of West Virginia and the highest elevations in Virginia and Tennessee in the Appalachian Mountains.
You're hoping to understand how trees respond to climate change in order to make predictions about the future. I'm not sure I understand how ancient DNA lets you do this.
Right. So we know that if we think about a tree species overall, like let's take red spruce as an example. Red spruce, its range, as I just mentioned, covers from New England to the southern Appalachians. But those are composed of different populations. So the southern populations are isolated from the populations in New England, and they probably don't exchange any pollen, so they don't exchange any genes because they're too far apart. So over long periods of time, those populations become adapted to the conditions that they're growing in. So southern populations, we might expect, would be more tolerant of warmer summers and perhaps drought conditions, whereas populations in the north are more adapted to the cold, moist conditions more common to New England. And so what we're trying to understand is how do these populations vary in their adaptation to climate. We won't be able to get that information from the ancient DNA. We will be able to get that from the modern DNA, so we can sequence the genomes of a large number of individuals of red spruce and look at their genetic composition. We're going to grow these individuals in common gardens. So we're taking about 350 individuals from all across the range and planting them in the same location and watching how they perform. And so that allows us to test, you know, if we take trees from Tennessee and we plant them in Vermont, do they perform poorly because they're not adapted to those conditions? So that gives us something about local adaptation. Looking to the past, we're more interested in looking at, do the patterns we see in this ancient material fit what we would predict in terms of responses to climate? And so we might say, as this place became warmer and drier through time, as climate warmed, do we also see associated changes in population size that's consistent with those changes in habitat suitability?
When do you think you'll have answers?
Well, I should say that the ancient DNA part of this project is the most risky part by far. So there's a chance that it might not work at all. Trying to reassemble these words, if you will, that we're hoping to extract from the DNA into a story, we just might not have enough of the story there to be able to read what's going on. But we hope to have answers probably in the next 2 to 3 years, I think, based on the project schedule.
I wish you luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for walking us through your research. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Matthew Fitzpatrick is an associate professor at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Frostburg. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to more information about ancient pollen. Quick break now on the record. When we're back, trees of record size in Maryland, how are they measured? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. A people without children would face a hopeless future. A country without trees is almost as hopeless. That's a line from the letter President Theodore Roosevelt wrote to U.S. school children in 1907 to honor Arbor Day. Trees offer us shade, clean air, a home base for games of tag, or shelter during hide-and-seek. Whether they bear pine needles or blossoms, whether their branches are bare or flaunting leaves of orange and gold, trees are one of nature's most beautiful gifts. And towering trees are an especially eye-catching presence on the landscape. How are big trees measured? Where can you see Maryland's trees of record size? Jolie McCatherine, co-chair of the Maryland Big Tree Program, is here with some answers. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila.
This Maryland Big Tree Program was started by a man named Fred Besley.
Correct. He was Maryland's first state forester.
When was that?
I don't know the exact year he started, but he started the Big Tree Program in 1925. And I think it was the Y Oak, the one that was in Y Mills, Maryland, that drew the attention to large champion trees.
Yeah, the Y Oak was in its prime then. It was enormous. It didn't die until 2002.
Correct. So. It was the largest white oak ever recorded in the state of Maryland or in the United States as well.
Why did he think it was important to be measuring trees?
He was very interested in logging, and that's how people used to be able to see how much wood was in a tree. And he started becoming interested in what are the largest trees in the state of Maryland. And that's why he started the big tree program.
How are trees measured?
Okay, it's a formula. You measure the circumference in inches and then the height in feet, and then you take north, south, and east, west spread of the tree, the branches out to the drip line each side. And then
the drip line is like
the outer edge, the farthest growing branches out of the tree. And then you actually divide that by 4, and that comes up with a formula that gives you a number. But when we publish trees, what's on our website, what's in our publication is the spread, one half the spread, because it's easier to visualize. So you'll see that the numbers don't add up, but if you divide that spread by four, you're going to get the correct number of the tree.
I'm thoroughly confused. I'm thororoughly confused by the math. It sounds like you're adding feet and inches.
Yes, we actually are. The circumference is always in inches, and then the height is in feet, and then we do feet of the spread, and we divide that by four, and that adds up to a total point of the tree.
So these are points.
These are points. It's a point system.
And what are the points that would apply to a big tree? What kind of numbers do you end up with?
The Y oak is a great example since we were discussing that. And that was, I believe, 506 points, which is absolutely enormous for a tree. We get very excited around anything around 300. Trees grow at different rates, so it's not necessarily by age, but by the size of the tree itself.
And you can keep track of how points change if you're keeping an eye on a tree?
We are required through American Forest and through the Maryland Big Tree Program to measure trees every 10 years to keep them on the list and to make sure they're still alive and actively growing.
What tools do you use to do these measurements?
A very simple tape measure. We have a hook on it so we can hook onto the bark of the tree. That does the circumference and that does the spread. And then we have either a hypsometer, I have a laser forestry pro to measure the height. You can use a clinometer to measure the height. So there are several different tools.
Hypsometer? What is that?
It's a laser unit that does a tangent style method where you measure the middle, the top, and the bottom. I prefer a sine method where I use two points, the base and the top and the laser. And that will give us the height of the tree.
So you need some algebra to do this.
You do.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jolie McCatherine of the Maryland Big Tree Program. We're talking about the most formidable trees in Maryland and how to measure them. Even though this is Maryland's Big Tree Program, not all the trees reach towering heights.
Some are very small. There's a definition of a tree has to be 7 inches in circumference and 13 feet tall. So we've come across some dogwoods, for example, which are never a very tall tree, but we've come across some good size circumferences. It's not going to be in the 200 or 300 range, but it's worthy. If it's the largest known of its species.
Where can people see some record trees in our area?
We just recently had a great team in Baltimore measure Wyman Park, Druid Hill Park, the Maryland Zoo in Baltimore, three locations. They're very easy to find on our website, and you can find the locations when they're public. We do add the coordinates and the location of where the tree is located.
So we can go to the website of the Maryland Big Tree Program, which we will link to from our website.
Yes.
And that will tell people can find.
You can divide it by tree species, or you can divide it by counties and cities. So if you click on the city of Baltimore, all those trees will come up. If you're looking for a specific species or genus or species under that, you can drill down to find that particular tree that you're interested in. And then we have some trees that are bicentennial trees. Maryland did a bicentennial tree program in 1976 for trees that were 200 years old and had been pre-measured. And those trees are also listed. The ones that are alive are listed there as well and marked.
What is the state champion in Maryland, the champion tree,
sure,
now that the Y oak is gone?
Yes. The largest white oak, which is the same kind of oak that was the Y oak, is in Calvert County. It's near an old meeting house. The largest known tree in the state of Maryland is a sycamore in Dickerson Conservation Park. It's 30 feet in circumference. If you start adding up those numbers, I think it's 575 points. The good thing is it's on public land, so it's accessible to the general public, which we love.
Dickerson Park is where?
It's northern Montgomery County.
What can people do if they think they have a particularly sizable tree on their property?
Again, on our website, there's a link, and you can nominate a tree through that, and it comes to me and to the other chair, John Bennett, and then we will set a date and go out and visit that tree. So we measure statewide.
Who is doing this measuring?
Of volunteers. We all are under the auspices of DNR, Department of Natural Resources, but we are all volunteers. So we do this out of our love for the work that Fred Besley started.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Jolie McCatherine is co-chair of the Maryland Big Tree Program. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to the Big Tree website. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.